Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tonight, where's Dick Cheney? Who's got the president's ear? Who's up? Who's down? We go inside the Bush administration with conservative commentator William Kristol for a look at how all the president's men and women are fighting the war on terrorism. First, a tough week for the economy ends badly with the release of the October unemployment figures. This month, the U.S. labor market lost 415,000 jobs, the biggest one-month drop in more than two decades. At a press briefing this morning, President Bush used the news to push for passage of the economic stimulus package.
I think it's very important for the administration and Congress to work together to extend and expand unemployment benefits to those whose lives have been affected by the attacks. And we need to work together to prevent further loss of jobs by passing an economic stimulus package that, in fact, will cause the job base to firm up and expand.
President Bush speaking this morning. I spoke earlier today with Greg Ipp, economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal, about how bad the numbers are.
The unemployment rate has shot up to 5.4% in October from 4.9% in September. That's the highest unemployment rate we've seen in this country in 5 years.
That's a 0.5 jump in a month. Is that unusual?
It's very unusual. You seldom see these kinds of dramatic moves, and it's clearly because of the severe impact so many parts of the economy have suffered in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks.
How can you draw a line, or draw it for us, if you would, Greg, between the September 11 attacks and these numbers?
I think the most obvious way to discern the impact of the attacks is by looking at where the job losses occurred. The decline in payrolls was about 415,000, which is the single largest one-month decline in jobs we've seen since 1980, and a lot of them, unusually, came from sectors which had been relatively stable or growing in prior months, and I'm thinking especially of services. And when you look within the numbers, you see there were big losses by airlines, by restaurants, by hotels, by car rental agencies. These are all clearly industries that are just reeling in the face of the slump in demand after the attacks.
Were people surprised by the extent of the slide in employment?
People were expecting negative numbers, but I don't think they were expecting to be this negative. Economists were looking for a decline in the order of 300,000 jobs, and in fact, as you know, it came in somewhat worse than that. But it doesn't really change the underlying picture, which is that the economy is very weak right now. It's almost certainly shrinking at a fairly rapid clip.
How about factory orders?
The Department of Commerce told us on Friday that factory orders fell some 5 or 6% in September. Wasn't terribly new news to us because we'd seen a preliminary advance on that, but that just tells us something that we'd had a good inkling of, which is that the factory sector, which was very weak through most of the year, but in fact had been showing some signs of stability in August, took another down leg in the wake of the terrorist attacks.
Are the impacts of the September attacks looking larger as we go forward? Are these bigger than people expected 2 and 3 and 4 weeks after the attack?
I think that what you're seeing is two rounds of effects. We know what the first round of effects was. There was a dramatic cutback in jobs by the airlines and by industries that depend very closely on travel, such as the hotels and so on. Mm-hmm. Then as the people who lost those jobs reduced their own spending, that reverberates through other areas of the economy, such as retail sales, and we're seeing cuts in those areas as well. So the short answer is no, we have not seen the end of these impacts. And whether this will actually turn out to be worse, it's still very hard to say. I mean, the October numbers were terrible, but it's hard to believe that they will continue to be as bad as this. Surely this will be the worst month because so many of the immediate impacts showed up right away. But that said, we've seen a lot of layoff announcements in the last month. We know that some of those have not yet been carried out. So it seems likely that we're going to continue to see the job cuts pile up in the coming months. And economists now expect the unemployment rate to be about 6% by early next year. That would be the highest it's been in 7 years.
What's the longer-term outlook at this point? We've heard economists say repeatedly that they're looking for a turnaround sometime next year, 2002, perhaps mid-year. Are people still singing that tune?
You know, unfortunately, it seems that that turnaround is always 3 to 6 months away, no matter where we are, and the optimism keeps getting postponed. There are some positive signs, though, in this gloom. Interest rates are far lower than they were even a month ago, and we fully expect the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates yet again on Tuesday. We do have a stimulus package in Washington, and if Congress can ever sort of break through their partisan squabbling, then that should be a big boost to the economy. And one of the unusual and very encouraging signs we've seen in recent weeks is that the stock market has gone up a lot and seems to have been able to hold on to that rally. And it's got a lot of people scratching their heads, but one thing we do know is that the stock market always, always spots the turn in the economy before it shows up in the headlines. Now, sometimes it gets it wrong. It sees a recovery when one doesn't, in fact, occur, and it gives it all back. But that said, it hasn't happened yet, so I think that is an encouraging sign.
Are there statistical reasons for confidence, or are there signs of light somewhere in the numbers that are coming out on production, on orders, anywhere?
I think the one thing we can point to and say this is a good sign for the future is the extent to which inventories have been run down so heavily by manufacturers. A very large proportion of the shipments that they are making are coming out of existing inventories. They're trying very hard to get those excess stocks down to try and conserve their working capital. And as a result, they've been idling factories and laying off workers. That can't go on forever. Eventually, you run out of inventories, and you have to start the production lines going again. Look at the car industry, for example. They had their best month on record of auto sales in October because of these 0% financing deals. Mm-hmm. But they've actually been on net reducing production schedules, so their inventories are down to very lean levels. If sales at all hold up at a decent level in December going into January, that's got to at some point flow through to an increase in production. So that would probably be the most encouraging sign on the economy out there.
Greg, there's been a lot of criticism in Washington of the stimulus package, but is the market's bit of rally recently a sign that Wall Street thinks the stimulus package may work?
I think Wall Street simply hopes that there will be a stimulus package and isn't terribly fussy about exactly what the nature of that stimulus package is. If for some reason the whole thing was derailed because the Congress and administration could not agree on something, that I think would clearly be a setback for Wall Street.
Greg Ipp is economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. I spoke to him earlier today from his Washington, D.C. office. The Bush administration says the war is going as planned, and polls show that so far the American people support the president. But who's driving this war? Colin Powell? Donald Rumsfeld? Condoleezza Rice? Behind each presidential announcement, decision, and strategy is an ongoing debate among George W. Bush's closest advisors. The personal dynamics, the policy divides, and the turf battles matter in this war on terrorism. What grades do you give the Bush administration so far? You can join the conversation this evening at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now is William Kristol. He's the editor of the Weekly Standard and always influential Washington conservative. He joins us from the studios of Monitor Radio in Washington. Good evening, William Kristol.
Good evening. How are you?
Well, thanks for being with us. And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Are you there, Jack? Oh, there we got you. Good to have you there, Jack. William Kristol, thanks very much for joining us this evening. The polls are very strong for President Bush. A CBS New York Times poll earlier this week says that nearly 8 in 10 respondents approve of the way that President Bush is handling the war on terror. But how do you think it's actually going? How's the Bush team doing at prosecuting the war on terror? And we'll look player by player, but I'd love to get your overview on the battlefront, on the home front, and maybe in American hearts and minds.
Well, I think the president did awfully well in the first couple of weeks, and there was a natural rallying to the president, obviously, after the attack, the way there always is. And then he rose to the occasion. You've got to say, after that maybe shaky first day, he had a couple of weeks where he pretty much did everything right, culminating in the speech September 20th to the Congress, which was a very effective speech, eloquent speech, effective. And he warned people there that this would be a long war, a difficult war, and in that way bought himself, I think, quite a lot of time and quite a lot of running room for the conduct of the war. And he's been able to say pretty much for the last 5-6 weeks, look, we said it would take a while. Don't be impatient for results. And he's even said at times, you know, this is a new situation, a different kind of war. You can't expect us to have some plan we can pull out of our back pocket to prosecute it in a sort of by-the-numbers way. And therefore, the American people have given him a lot of leeway, and I imagine will for the next while. I think if you look at the war, if you look at the home front and the Afghan front, which are the two fronts we're engaged in, In Afghanistan, I think they made a change this week. I mean, the light bombing campaign they were conducting wasn't working. The political side of it wasn't working. The attempt to put together an alliance that could replace the Taliban, which is why they were cutting back on the bombing to try to not let the Northern Alliance go in and take Kabul. They wanted to put together a comprehensive sort of governing coalition even before they got rid of the current governing regime. That fell apart. There were setbacks militarily. Basically, our allies have made no progress on the ground. Rumsfeld, I know, stepped up the bombing considerably this week. There's now serious talk about special operations forces, and I think down the road we'll see U.S. ground troops in there, because I think you need ground troops to win the war.
William Crystal, pull that, before we go to the home front,
yeah,
pull that back to the players engaged inside the administration. What are the different agendas at work there in the first more measured pace and now in this stepped-up pace? What's the tension? What are the polls there?
Well, I mean, to oversimplify only a little, I would say this was Colin Powell's war for the first 4 or 5 weeks, and now it's Don Rumsfeld's war. It was a war, and maybe that's appropriate, incidentally. I myself prefer the Rumsfeld approach, but one could say, look, what you've got to do first is secure the coalition in the Muslim world. It doesn't matter that much. You could argue how fast you win in Afghanistan. You can sacrifice some of your military goals for some political considerations. But that changed this week, and I think what changed it was the consideration that letting this drag out too long actually endangers our political goals, because Pakistan is more vulnerable the longer this drags out. Osama becomes more of a hero in the Muslim world the longer this drags out. There's a real premium now, I think the administration believes, in winning the war in Afghanistan quickly, or at least making it clear that we're going to win the war in Afghanistan pretty soon, and using decisive force and showing that we're not in some endless gradual escalation in Afghanistan. Because the political price, I mean, A, it would be good to win it anyway quickly, obviously, but the political price we'll pay elsewhere for letting it drag on through the winter and into the spring is pretty considerable. So Rumsfeld, I think, has won that debate in the administration. He's got to beat up his own military, which has a fondness for air wars and doesn't like sending ground troops into a place like Afghanistan. And some of the biggest fights in the administration are not just between Rumsfeld and Powell. Those have been covered extensively in the press. And actually, I don't think are particularly bitter fights. They're honest disagreements that you'd kind of expect to have between a defense secretary and a secretary of state. Some of the biggest fights are between the civilian leadership in the Pentagon, which wants an aggressive prosecution of this war, and the military, which is very concerned about U.S. casualties, which is cautious, which likes fighting an air war, which likes strategic bombing campaigns, doesn't like close tactical air support, certainly doesn't like too much use of ground troops. So Rumsfeld's going to have to assert his authority in the Pentagon, I think, and I think that'll be one of the stories to watch over the next couple of weeks.
This is the military, after all, that produced Colin Powell, the more measured pace guy.
That's a very good point. I mean, you have a funny alliance of the State Department, led by Colin Powell, and the uniformed military now, against the civilian leadership in defense, led by Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy secretary, and to some degree, Dick Cheney, the vice president, a former secretary of defense, who went through this himself in the Gulf War. I was in the Bush administration. It's been well reported how much Cheney had to sort of beat up his own military, led then by Colin Powell, to try to get troops sent to the Gulf, to get a much more aggressive war plan. He went around the Joint Chiefs at key moments to come up with a more aggressive air war and ground war strategy. So you have, I'd say, Cheney and his staff, Rumsfeld and his top civilian people pushing for a more aggressive war, Powell and the military favoring other considerations, and President Bush and Condi Rice for the tiebreaker.
We're going to talk this hour about exactly how the Bush administration shifts gears when it shifts gears. But Jack Beattie, I want to pull you in here. What do you see from your perch in New Hampshire as you look down toward Washington? Bill Kristol's right next to it. But from your distance, do you see an effective administration?
Well, Secretary Rumsfeld said some weeks ago that the coalition doesn't drive the mission. The mission drives the coalition. And I think that probably tracking what Bill said, that the coalition was driving the mission for the first few weeks, and now it's the mission that's driving the coalition. But the question is, really, what's the state of that coalition? I think to a lot of us, it's been a kind of a revelation of just how little of a coalition it is. It's a, as we've said before on this program, a kind of notional coalition, with the exception of Pakistan, which is really taking a big risk. And I think we've been finding out one by one of these countries that they really haven't been doing much for us, or at least not much that we can see.
Jack Beattie, hold on. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and look at how the Bush administration sees that with William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard, and our own Jack Beattie. What grade would you give the Bush administration's handling of the crisis so far? Who has your confidence on the Bush team? What worries you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the Bush administration sizing up their effectiveness as a team, their effectiveness in war. We're joined by William Crystal, editor of the Weekly Standard, and our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Just before the break, we were talking about the coalition and how the Bush administration might look out at that. William Crystal in Washington, give us a sense of how this administration looks out at an issue like that. Colin Powell's put a lot of work into building the coalition, but do they see it as just a notional coalition, or is it more important? And how does that conversation unfold inside? Is it just George Bush and Condoleezza Rice having morning coffee and deciding it together, or do they all sit down and hash out a view over a big table? How's it work?
Well, when they're all in town, they get together every morning, and if they're not there, they get together by video conference. So there's a 9:30 morning a.m. meeting that lasts about an hour of the top, the war cabinet, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Bush, Cheney, Powell, Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, George Tenet, the CIA chief, sometimes maybe the attorney general, a couple of deputies. So that is the team. Now, my own view on this is that contrary to conventional wisdom, Bush is not going to let Colin Powell or Rumsfeld end up running this war. I do think he thinks this is his mission. You know, September 11th will define his presidency.
He said so.
He said it was the country's mission and our generation's mission. But I think it's really a personal thing for him. My colleague Fred Barnes, an old friend and colleague of Jack Beatty's too, I think, had a good piece in the magazine, Weekly Standard, a couple of weeks ago, doing some reporting on the extent to which the president has almost a religious view that he was called to be president, perhaps, to run this war. So he will defer at times to Powell and at times to Rumsfeld, but I think he knows this is his war. And I think the underreported aspect, therefore, of the way the White House is running this war is that it's very much George W. Bush with Condoleezza Rice at his right hand, who I think will ultimately make the big decisions. I personally think that's kind of a good thing. I don't think you want a president who defers to the bureaucracies and to his cabinet offices too much. He's the one who has to balance these things. It does put a big weight on his shoulders. But I think we're probably, you know, it's fun to, I mean, I believe me, I've written like everyone else about Rumsfeld and Powell and all that. But I don't think we should kid ourselves. This will be Bush's war. He will win it or not.
That relationship with Condoleezza Rice is such a fascinating relationship. What's the root of that? And what has it become in personal, in intellectual terms?
Well, I don't, you know either of them well, and don't want to sort of excessively psychoanalyze this. They haven't known each other that long, so it's not as if they go back 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's not like the former President Bush and Brent Scowcroft, for example. But I think if you're Bush, and look, I've been told this by people who've talked to him and who've been around these meetings. If you're President Bush, you have a high regard for Colin Powell. He's the most popular and respected man in America. You're happy to have him as Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he's a man of stature who doesn't really you're younger than he is. He's had a very distinguished political career, a public career, I should say, even before you were doing anything, basically.
Right.
And he's at the State Department. And I think Bush is suspicious of the pinstripe types at the State Department, full of people he knew at Yale and didn't like. Then you look at Don Rumsfeld, again, of more of his father's generation than of his own, a distinguished public servant, smart guy, tough guy. But again, no personal rapport there. And I think Bush thinks to himself, I'm happy I have Rumsfeld and those guys running defense, kicking the uniform military a little bit and being tough guys. I'm happy I have Powell and all these effective diplomats at state. But when Bush looks around and thinks, well, who's thinking about it the way I'm thinking about it? Who can really give me advice that's not colored by institutional affiliations? I think he looks at the vice president, Dick Cheney, and he really looks most of all at Condi Rice. They're the same generation, about 5 years apart. She spends many weekends at Camp David. They exercise together sometimes in addition to all the meetings they have together. In any case, even if they weren't sort of the same generation, the national security advisor often becomes, just because of proximity, the guy closest to the president in administrations. I think that was true of Clinton and Sandy Berger, for example. Mm-hmm. He had a much closer relationship with Berger than with Madeleine Albright or Bill Cohen. But here I think it's even generational, and I just have the sense, and I more than a sense, this is based on talking to some people, that Condi Rice is awfully influential in helping George Bush think through what he wants to do.
Jack Beatty, do you see a precedent for that relationship, and where do you see Condoleezza Rice's fingerprints in George Bush's view?
Well, I really don't know enough about her or about her mind on these matters. She made an unfortunate, I think, appearance in the campaign with a flip remark, which she, I think, later regretted about the use of U.S. forces in nation building. And, of course, now the administration, if things go well or when they go well in Afghanistan, is going to be involved through the U.N. willy-nilly in lots of nation building. So I really don't know much more about her than that appearance. But I do find this rather sort of bracing. I mean, here's a minority woman who's the chief advisor to the president of the United States, who's a Republican. And I just can't help but think that all things being equal, I just like the symbolism of that.
It's a great vision.
Yeah, and I think just seeing that is good for the country. I mean, that sounds corny to say, but I guess I believe that.
William Crystal, we saw a lot of intimacy between Dick Cheney and the president early on. Now Dick Cheney's gone underground. Where is he, or, you know, hypothetically, where is he, and where do you see his role right now?
Well, I don't know where he is, and I guess I wouldn't say if I did.
But I mean, he's in a bunker somewhere.
He's in a secure location, right. Which is pretty startling. I mean, I will say this. This is unprecedented, of course, in our lifetimes. I mean, probably in American history so far. So I know I worked for a vice president. I was Dan Quayle's chief of staff. And, you know, there always were concerns, especially if there were reports of possible of troublemaking or even attacks on the White House or the president, to separate the president and the vice president. The tradition has been that they tend not to fly together. They tend to they're obviously together in the White House during the day, but they keep them apart on most trips and mm-hmm. at many events in case something were to happen. Obviously, to the president, the vice president would be fine.
But how do you interpret this extreme stuff?
Well, I don't know. I'm a little spooked by it, frankly. I'm sure they're doing I trust they're doing the right thing in the sense that they must have reason to believe that there's a serious threat. If you think hard about it, why would you keep the vice president of the United States in hiding at a secure location, probably a considerable distance from the Capitol, only if you thought there was a real threat of a serious assault on the president, maybe a simultaneous assault on the president and the vice president, maybe the kind of assault that would be of sufficient gravity and severity that it would endanger the continuity of government, even if they were in the same city, even if they weren't in the same place.
But in fairness, we
speculate.
Saw,
I even hate to even speculate about these things.
But we saw a jetliner. We saw a jetliner go right into the Pentagon. Did plenty of damage. The White House is a lot smaller than the Pentagon. Need it be anything more than that?
And you read about suitcase bombs, and I don't even, really sort of hate to even speculate about this, and I know nothing that anyone else doesn't know from reading the paper, but I am struck. Maybe they're just being very careful, and certainly no one would begrudge them that at this point.
But from that remote location, wherever it is, what role do you see Cheney playing, or can you tell?
It's a little hard to tell. His staff is certainly more involved and more central to the White House than we were when I was in the vice president's staff. And I think even more perhaps than Al Gore's staff. Gore was said to be the most influential vice president in American history, which is probably true. Cheney has, I think, topped him on that. I gather that Cheney's quiet at most meetings, keeps his advice for the president for when they are alone together, which they are a fair amount of time, and they obviously talk on the phone when he's out of town. Cheney's both – it's hard to say where Cheney will end up, I think, in some of these debates, but obviously Bush depends on him quite a bit.
Yeah, and his fingers have been showing up elsewhere. I mean, they're in the stimulus bill, for example, which includes a repeal of the alternative minimum tax, basically a tax on corporations that otherwise would pay no taxes. And Paul Krugman, in a very gimlet-eyed analysis, noted that this alternative minimum tax is going to pay a lot of money to companies like Chevron, Enron, Phillips Petroleum, ICM Global, CMS Energy, all of which have one thing in common. They're in Texas. They're either in the energy business or extractive industry. And it's the same cast of corporations that was going to benefit immeasurably or disproportionately from Cheney's energy plan.
Bill Crystal, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Sounds like we've lost Jack Beatty, but I ought to give you a chance.
Can you hear me?
Oh, we've got you back. Yeah,
Cheney, can you hear me?
Cheney's so powerful, he pulled the plug on Jack.
Did you hear my populist rant here?
Yes, that was good.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I was actually building up to one other point. According to the Financial Times, it was Cheney who this week or recently intervened on the location of the World Trade Organization meeting. It's going to be held now in Qatar, mm-hmm. and but the feeling in the trade office was, no, we got to move this because it's too dangerous there. And our intelligence people apparently said it is too dangerous there. It's so dangerous, in fact, that congressional representatives are going to be very few showing up. But Cheney intervened. He says, no, we're going to have it in Qatar. I don't want to find out that Halliburton Energy, Mr. Cheney's former employer, has anything to do with the government of Qatar. I don't want to know that. But
William Crystal, I better give you a chance to respond to Jack here.
I have no idea if Halliburton has anything to do with the government of Qatar, but I don't know that Dick Cheney has any interest anymore in Halliburton, I guess, except in nostalgia for the good old days. I would say this about Cheney, that one thing that strikes me, having worked for a vice president, is normal. If Cheney were, so to speak, a normal vice president, that is some governor who'd been selected to balance the senator to balance the ticket with Bush, the way you would run a war normally, and I think this is true in U.S. history basically, is the president would become the war president. He would have a war cabinet, which the vice president would be part of. But basically, you would ask your vice president to do an awful lot of the domestic policy side of things. Now, Cheney, of course, doesn't really want to do that, maybe with the exception of a couple of things like a little bit of weighing in on the stimulus package. Cheney wants to be a war vice president, not a domestic vice president, and that certainly is where his talents lie. What that means is that I think you could argue that in domestic policy, there's a bit of a surprising vacuum. There's no sort of assistant president for domestic policy right now, which normally I think would be the role that a vice president would perform. I don't criticize this. I think Cheney is better used as a sort of assistant president for foreign policy.
But unusual,
and it does mean that I think that I just saw a Republican pretty close to the Bush White House today, not a member of the administration, but a prominent Republican, worried that there's not enough high-level attention to the economy and to domestic policy in general.
Bill Crystal and Jack Beatty, we've got a lot of callers who want to join the conversation. Let's invite them in. We're talking about the Bush administration. What report card do you give them after, what is it now, 6 weeks in the war on terrorism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line. Welcome, David.
Hi, how are you all?
We're well, thanks.
I think Mr. Beatty stole a little bit of my populist rant. I was going to ask Mr. Crystal if he didn't think that President Bush was squandering a kind of amazing rallying behind him with this incredibly naked giveaway to his own political constituents. It seems like he's in danger of becoming the carpetbagger of his own war.
Which giveaway in particular are you talking about, David?
The stimulus package. I mean, it's unbelievable. Here's a president. Everybody's ready to line up behind him and go over the edge. And he does this amazing. He pulls this amazing political gaffe.
Bill Crystal, what about it? Is this bad political antenna in the White House or not?
It could be. I mean, I haven't. I've been so wrapped up in the war that I probably haven't followed the stimulus package as much as I should have. Plus, I guess I agree with your earlier guest from the Wall Street Journal. I'm not so sure the stimulus package makes that much difference. My impression was that the House Republicans were the key in developing the stimulus package. They're perfectly happy. They are a corporatist-oriented group. A lot of leaders from Texas happy to give tax breaks or tax giveaways to major corporations, not just energy companies. I think IBM gets $1.5 billion from the repeal of the alternate minimum tax. Or the give back of 15 years of ultimate minimum taxes, tax credits to the to corporations. So I think the Democrats can make some hay if Republicans stick with this corporatist oriented bill. It is striking to me, though, that my impression is that Bush personally and even the Bush White House hasn't been that much involved in this. And in fact, if you talk to Republicans on the Hill, they're complaining that they can't get much guidance from the Bush White House. You have the weird phenomenon, not weird, maybe it's a predictable phenomenon, of the Bush White House pretty focused on the war and on the home front war, the anthrax and all that. Congress is back to its usual games. Democrats want to increase the size of government. Republicans want to give tax breaks to corporations. We could argue about that, I guess, endlessly. But there's a weird disconnect, it seems to me, between the White House on the one hand and Congress, in both parties in Congress on the other.
It not being as engaged with war. Jack Beatty, I think I heard you wanting to jump in there with Brother David.
I was going to underline what he said. I mean, Fred Wertheimer of Common Cause calls this the War Profiteering Act of 2001. And it's a shame that the president hasn't stepped up to this because, before there was a perception of him solidifying, and there's poll results showing this around before the war, just before the war, that he was the type of president for the rich people and for corporations. And it was based on his tax cut, and it was based on his energy program and lots of other things. And for those 2 weeks, he was suddenly the president of all the people, he actually went and honored public servants, union members, some of the 366 people who died in the policemen and firemen who died in the World Trade Center. And he was talking about solidarity and unity. And along comes this wish list of giveaways to corporations that economists, or of course not economists who aren't, you know, bought, basically say, hey, how is making a permanent tax cut for a corporation going to stimulate things now? And by the way, is this the way to stimulate an economy, or is the best way to stimulate it to give people who spend every last dime of the money they get in consumption? And of course, what we found out from the last round of tax cuts was that most people, because it went mostly to people who paid taxes, put the money in the bank. They didn't spend it. And
Jack and Bill, we've got callers who want to go in other directions here. We got the point there. Okay. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Roger is on the line. Hello, Roger.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Jack, I echo everything you say. On the domestic side, it's absolutely unconscionable and shameful what these guys are doing, giving away millions and millions to corporations and rich people when it's the little guys that are suffering. And let me just, I'll move on to my actual point. It was on the foreign policy, but the giveaway to the airlines is right up the same kettle of fish. They give the airlines $15 billion. The airlines turn around and fire 100,000 people. And one more piece that the Republicans are trying to sneak into the stimulus package is to remove the salary cap that was put in as part of the bailout.
Roger, you've got a point also on the foreign front, and we're coming up on a break. Give it to
us. Okay, here's the foreign point. They've totally bungled the most important piece of this battle, which is the heart and mind of the middle-class moderate Arab. And had they taken a little more time to build the coalition, had they waited to attack until this anthrax stuff came out, I think they really could have turned the tide had they had some actors in the Middle East getting out the message of the rational people of the world that these guys are nutballs, that they could have turned the tide. But by ignoring the PR dimension, they've played right into bin Laden's hands.
We got it, Roger, and we're coming up on a break. Thanks for your call. Let me put it to Bill Kristol. You've looked at it just the other way, I think, Bill Kristol. Yeah. You've talked about, or in an upcoming column, you're talking about an eerie lack of urgency in Washington about the war. Yeah, what about the battle for hearts and minds?
I think we win the battles for hearts and minds in large part by showing everyone in the world that if you kill Americans, you pay a huge and horrible and terrible price. And, you know, most people don't dislike America, or if they dislike it, they certainly don't want to kill Americans. You're not going to immediately change deep-seated religious and cultural traditions and views. What you can do is to tell the fence sitters that they want to be on America's side, not against America. So I'm all for public diplomacy. I'm all for winning hearts and minds. But I think one way to do it is to win this war in Afghanistan quickly and decisively.
I think Roger may have a different view, but along those lines, how do you think the Bush administration is doing at speed of victory?
Well, I think they've sped it up this week, but I'm worried that we took too long. I mean, either you should delay it for 6 months or not delay at all, and there was no way you're going to delay for 6 months. I mean, look, what more PR could we have done? Well, we have to prove bin Laden killed 5,000 Americans in cold blood. It's perfectly evident. We warned the Taliban. We asked them to hand them over. We've tried very hard to target the bombing. We've done huge humanitarian food drops. I think the Bush administration has done its best there. Some people don't want to be convinced. They want to hate America. They want to hate Israel. We're not going to change their minds overnight. What we can do is make them fear taking on America and make them, sort of subside in terms of supporting and harboring terrorists.
Now, Bill Kristol, we've got to take a quick break here. We'll come right back. I'm afraid we've got a break. We're talking with Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, and our own Jack Beatty about how the Bush administration is doing in the war on terror. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK or online at WBOR.org. Click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. We'll be right back. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Bush administration and how it's doing in prosecuting the war on terrorism abroad and at home. We're joined this evening by William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Bill Kristol, I'm sorry we had to cut off for the break there. I want to let you finish that point. And then I'd love it if you'd look at the homeland front for a second. We've talked about the war abroad, but what about the homeland front and the main players there, John Ashcroft, Tommy Thompson, Tom Ridge, and so on? Give us your quick rundown.
Well, Tom, let me just briefly finish the previous point.
Yes, please.
Not to go on, I feel like I've probably horrified so many WBUR listeners with my bloodthirsty hawkishness and my paraphrase of Machiavelli's.
People are fainting all over.
It's better to be feared than loved. That I would do want to add one thing. I do think wars have many unanticipated effects and consequences. One of the consequences of this war, which I welcome, is a rethinking of American policy towards the Arab world, an American policy that has propped up dictatorships that we thought were pro-American. I think Jack alluded to this earlier. We're now learning an awful lot about the Saudis, for example, that we didn't know before.
Sure,
most of us didn't know before. Mm-hmm. And I think there'll be a fundamental rethinking of whether we have been wise to prop up these allegedly pro-American dictators, whether we're not paying a great price for that now, and whether we need to be more serious about democracy and human rights, even in the Arab world.
You know, so
Arabs,
you're saying,
Arabs have the same human rights as everyone else does.
You're saying so iron fist up front and then become the democratic crusader?
I believe that's exactly what we did in World War II. It's really what we did in the Cold War in large measure. And I think that, in fact, is the way. You have to beat the terrorists and beat them decisively and discredit the regime, beat the regimes that harbor them. But then you do have to be something of a democratic crusader, I'd say.
Bill Kristol, it's always bracing to get your conservative view here in the seat of Boston. But take us to the homeland, to the home front, if you will. How are the major players doing there? John Ashcroft, Tommy Thompson, Tom Ridge, and right on down.
You know, it's honestly so hard to tell because we don't know about terrorist threats that might have been averted that obviously aren't public, et cetera. I would say the general perception one has is that the home front has not been dealt with as competently, as effectively, really as seriously as the foreign policy side. Whatever you think of the Powell or Rumsfeld and the disputes among them, no one doubts that they're serious people who are devoting all their time to trying to figure out as best as they can how to win this war abroad. I would say on the home front, there's been a little more of a sense of confusion. Tom Ridge was brought in, obviously, after, September 20th, or didn't really get there for another couple of weeks. He's a governor of Pennsylvania, a nice man, but no particular experience in doing what he's now doing. He's supposed to coordinate all of this. Tommy Thompson, the secretary of HHS, Health and Human Services, was brought in really for his expertise on welfare reform. Suddenly he's coordinating a public health challenge.
Anthrax.
Yeah, anthrax. So I think there's been some fumbling around. My main beef with them would be this. No one could begrudge them fumbling, making mistakes. No one's been through this before. Of course they were going to make mistakes. But if you make a mistake, say you've made a mistake. Say you're changing course. And say we're now really determined to do better. I think what people resent, at least my sense from talking to people, is this insistence that everything's going as we thought. Everyone's doing a great job.
Yeah, it's all under control.
It's all under control. They should admit that it's not quite all under control. And people will give them a lot of leeway. Everyone understands this is an awfully tough thing to manage. So I think you have to give them a great of incomplete on the home front, and I think there's some danger there unless they can sort of tighten the operation and just be more candid with the American people.
Let's listen to our callers for a minute. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're looking at the report card on the Bush administration 6 weeks into the war on terror. Irina is on the line. Welcome, Irina.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that we have to admit that things are not under control, not just on the home front, but we can't just take, the President Bush says the war is going well and swallow that. And I think it's interesting that Bill Kristol just said that, we're finding out things about the Saudis we didn't know before. Lots of us did know before about all kinds of things about the dictatorships that we prop up all over the world and that we sell arms to in Iran, in Afghanistan through Pakistan. And I think people, as all of you are, people in the media who talk about what do we know so far about this war, you have to talk more about what you don't know. There's all kinds of secret deals going on right now. You must be sure of that. What kind of deal are we making with Pakistan, with Uzbekistan? And it's really sad because we are, to get their support for this war, we're making deals with them where we say, we'll sell you arms, we'll look askance at your human rights abuses. And how many thousands of people are going to die because of these deals we're making compared to 5,000 people in New York? It's a shame. I don't think anyone is reviewing the foreign policy in the government.
Irina, thanks for your call. We're trying to dig in here every night, but let us dig in with Bill Kristol right now. Do you have a sense, William Kristol, that there are new deals being struck that are going to be costly to the United States, either in financial terms or in terms of human rights associations down the road? We are dealing with some tougher customers than usual here.
Yeah, and one of my objections to Powell's emphasis on coalition building is that I think we are sacrificing or could sacrifice too much in terms of human rights, among other interests we have and principles we hold, in cutting deals with some of these countries. Now, most of these deals are perfectly public, incidentally. You can read in the paper about what we're proposing to do for Pakistan, lifting sanctions, lots of aid. Uzbekistan, that's pretty public. Russia is a very obvious case where we've very much muted our criticism of their behavior in Chechnya. And I think that's a problem. I don't think most of the members of the coalition are not worth, frankly, what we're giving, or not most, but some of the members of the coalition are probably not worth what we may be giving here in terms of backing off in human rights and other concerns. So that's one reason I've never been a big fan of the coalition building. Pakistan, you know, if you really need a country, Uzbekistan, you have to swallow some things you don't want to swallow in the short term. But even so, I would agree that we should be careful over the longer term.
Sultan is calling from Salem, New Hampshire. Welcome, Sultan. You're on the air.
How are you?
Well, thanks.
At the beginning of the war, President Bush said that we are not going to bomb. We'll take a pause on Friday because of sensitivities of the Muslims. And now we are even saying we're going to go ahead with B-52s right through the Ramadan. My point is that the people, quote-unquote, this conservative in administration and in the press and the media like Bill Kristol and Chuck Krauthammer and Paul Wolfowitz and Jeff Jacoby, those kind of people who are really want to expand the war and spread it as much as they can, is that the winning now? Because now we are saying we're going to use anything, you know, let alone Friday. We are talking about Ramadan now. It doesn't matter anymore.
Well, we've got Bill Kristol right here. Let's put it to him. Bill Kristol, you seem to be making no bones about your desire to see the war be fiercer and faster. But does that risk, as I think Sultan is suggesting, if you don't have that quick victory, that you just gain more enmity?
Well, I think we can win a quick victory, and I don't think you can go into war and fight it with the assumption that you're not going to win. So, you know, if you follow that logic, I would say, well, then don't fight the war, because you're going to have the enmity whether you drop 200-pound bombs or 500-pound bombs on the Taliban front lines, frankly.
Well, I guess Colin Powell, for one, is talking about a more
I am
measure.
For fighting a war against Saddam Hussein, for example, because I think he's clearly developing weapons of mass destruction, which he will use against us, but also against his own people. And in this respect, I'm a liberal and a Democrat. I mean, I think one of the problems, or the great mistake of not deposing Saddam in 1991, one of the mistakes was is the signal it sent to many in the Arab world that we didn't care about the people of the Arab world. We didn't want to liberate Iraq from this dictator when we were very close to being able to do so. Instead, we wanted to defend Kuwait, which was fine, and secure our interests in the area and stability in the area, which was fine, and then we left. So I agree with the sort of liberal critics of U.S. policy in the sense that I think we can do more for the Arab people, but to do more for the Arab people and for people in Muslim countries around the world, we have to crush the terrorist organizations and we have to remove the regimes that harbor them and help them, or at least pressure the regimes that help them so they change their policies.
Bill Kristol, where is that Iraq issue within the administration right now? We know there's a wing that would like to go right on after them. Is that being held in abeyance, or is it just waiting for its moment?
It's been, I think the president has put it in abeyance, and I think something will depend on what we learn about the anthrax, for example, and what we learn about the contacts between, for example, Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker, who went to Prague, it seems, this summer only for the reason of meeting with an Iraqi intelligence agent, so far as we can see. A lot will depend on how close those ties turn out to be, if there are ties, and I rather suspect there are, but I don't know, obviously. And then a lot will depend on, obviously, a hard-headed judgment of what can we do about Saddam and the weapons of mass destruction. But I do not think this overall war will end in Afghanistan. I mean, either because we don't want, not just because we won't want it to end, or people like me are agitating for it not to end, but because wars have a way of leading to consequences that you don't anticipate early on. And obviously one of those consequences could be the fall of certain Arab dictatorships, a turmoil in the Arab world, an Arab-Israeli war. There are a lot of bad consequences. There could be good consequences. There's real activity in Iran that is hopeful, I think, for the forces for democracy and freedom there. And one of the weird consequences of this war could be actually a kind of helpful evolution in Iran. So I think we're in a time of great fluidity and unpredictability in that whole region.
William Kristol, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Always great to have you.
Thanks, Tom, and it was good talking to Jack, if only indirectly here.
William Kristol,
nice to talk to you.
Editor of the Weekly Standard. Jack Beatty, you heard a lot there. What do you think?
Well, as Bill was going down the human rights path, I was nodding my head. It's clear that we have made arrangements with these regimes based on our interests, oil, stability, that have to a certain extent undercut, or not to a certain extent, to a remarkable extent, undercut our values. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Saudi Arabia, according to Human Rights Watch, just the past couple of weeks, 16 homosexuals were sentenced to 1,800 lashes. Now, that's the kind of country we're supporting. And it's all about our oil, not about our values. The tricky thing, as, of course, other people have said, is, well, if we're going to make democracy and human rights the issue, we're going to destabilize those regimes. And then what replaces them may not be democracy and human rights, but Islamists. So it's a very tricky mare's nest. We want to affirm our principles, but we have to, I think, be pragmatic about it and recognize just how much even our human rights concerns, at least now, have to be subordinated to the war on al-Qaeda.
Jack, we've just got a second, but yes or no, do you see in the Bush administration the readiness to go in as democratic crusaders once we've gotten through the military part of this?
I just don't know. I don't sense that. And I just don't know. I could see there's a wing of the Republican Party, the John McCain wing, that would love to do that. Question is that heard in this administration?
Jack, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, the politics of fashion. Camilla Parnham is a physician from Cambridge, Massachusetts. On Fridays, since September 11th, this non-Muslim woman shows her solidarity with Muslim women around the world by wearing the head covering called the hijab.
It was a political statement. Ina Mae Gaskin, an audacious social activist, called on American women to show solidarity with Islamic women by wearing hijab. Cover your heads on October 8th, she wrote in an email. Wear a headscarf as often as you can, daily, once a week, through the end of October. It was such a simple idea. I was surprised at the mix of emotions that it conjured in my heart. That email made me ashamed of my actions of a week before. On a morning in late September, I had bolted upright in bed at 7:45 a.m., remembering the 7:50 teacher conference that would be starting at my son's suburban school, 10 minutes away. I am an African-American woman with caramel skin and medium-length dreadlocks. Already late, I had made myself even later. I had frozen at the door of my home, turned around, and wasted 10 precious minutes grooming my dreads rather than walk through that threshold wearing a scarf over my head. I was afraid to leave my home with my head covered. I was afraid that I might look a little too much like one of them. Ina May's email hit me in a very personal way. I felt her saying to me, across the computer lines, with her 60-plus years of grace and compassion, "Be brave, Camilla. Walk through your fear to the other side." So Fridays became my day. I rifled through my wardrobe, matched scarves to my outfits, and wore hijab to work. When the gas station attendant stared a little too hard as he cleaned my windshield, I remembered my divorced Lebanese patient in overwhelm as she tries to raise two Americanized teen daughters alone. When I greeted a new patient in my waiting room and saw them do a double take as I introduced myself, I remembered my black Muslim patient who wears hijab and her sister who does not. When I panicked as I crossed the street, imagining the car in front of me speeding up rather than slowing down, I remembered the quiet introspection of a 15-year-old who chose to wear hijab a year ago and who sees herself on a spiritual path. There are many ways to grow courage and many ways to show one's patriotism. I am grateful that Ina May's invitation allowed me to try out new versions of both.
Camilla Parnham is a physician from Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? How are the attacks in Afghanistan affecting you? Send your submissions for radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.